veux faire une entorse au protocole en parlant français pour remercier les organisateurs Barbara Romanovich et Jan Klinger de m'avoir invité. And now I'm going to speak English because otherwise I would be politically incorrect. So I wish to talk a little bit about tsunami, which is a field that has kept me busy for most of my career. And the emphasis I want to give today is, if you have a full screen view, no, full screen mode. Okay, thank you. The emphasis I want to give today is really to explain how tsunamis can present the Earth as a system of very significantly different materials, a solid Earth, an ocean, maybe also an atmosphere, which happen to be coupled. And the tsunami residing in the ocean, in that layer which sits between two media which are so different from each other and from itself, can be a way to examine very subtle ways to couple what I call eclectic media. And without further ado, tsunami, as you know, is a gravitational oscillation of a mass of water of the ocean following a disturbance of the ocean. You will find it both in French and in English, the word tidal wave or raz-de-marée or flutwelle in German. And of course, this has absolutely nothing to do with tides. And only in those countries which don't have too many tsunamis do they use these words raz-de-marée, because they refer to something which is well known, which is the tide, which comes twice a day. But unfortunately, this has nothing to do with tides. But in those countries where they do have tsunamis, such as maybe in Italy or in the Spanish-speaking countries or in Marquesan or in Japanese, they have a special word. And this is why we use the word tsunami, which means harbor wave in Japanese. Now, tsunamis are generated by earthquakes, landslides, volcanic explosion, bolide impacts, and also by meteorological phenomena. I've used a different font, not only a different color, but a different point size, to emphasize that most tsunamis are generated by earthquakes, even though tsunamis occur in water and earthquakes occur in the solid earth. So that already points out to something that there must be some kind of coupling between the two there, that we may learn something from. Landslides are a very tricky issue because, yes, they take place inside the oceanic column, and therefore they can trigger tsunami, but we don't know too much about them. Even though they can play quite a role in generating tsunamis. Volcanic eruptions are very tricky because they can take place both in the water column and above the water column. They lead to this business of coupling between the atmosphere and the water. Now, of course, bolide impacts, we will all die from one day, like the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. They can contribute to mega tsunamis, but there is only, to my knowledge, one really very well documented case, and that's Chicxulub 65 million years ago. So the classical approach to studying tsunamis is described in this diagram here. You have an equilibrium situation here, and during an earthquake, you push up here a kind of plug at the bottom, and you can think of a generation of a tsunami by saying, I just move the water from the bottom to the top, it creates a hump, and of course the hump is unstable, so the hump flows away, and that's the tsunami wave, and if you wait long enough, you end up with the new equilibrium position, for which the surface of the sea really hasn't changed because the sea is so large that the excess water has been spread over it and the average altitude of the sea hasn't changed. This has been used and is used every day to simulate tsunamis, but there is something inherently wrong here, which is this assumption that the water is transferred to the surface. And this assumption is wrong because we all know that it doesn't occur like this, and there are analytical solutions by people like Hammack in the 70s and so on, which provide a better description. But there is a lot of physics here because it's a question of timing. You move an earthquake wave a dislocation at the bottom of the ocean very quickly, and therefore you do something quickly. When you do something quickly in physics, I was taught many, many years ago, actually across the street at Le Louis Le Grand, across the street, I was taught that when you do something quickly, you do it irreversibly. And when you do something irreversibly, you spend more energy than if you were doing it reversibly, one step at a time, you know, one of these steps here at a time. And this excess of energy is what creates the tsunami energy. And I could, if I had more time, I could go through all the derivation, but you have to keep in mind that in the inter-seismic period, we don't have any tsunamis. When you deform ever so slightly the material at the bottom of the ocean during the interseismic period, because you do it so slowly that the system has the time to readjust itself to equilibrium before you generate waves. So we have to keep this in mind. A few numbers very quickly for those of you who may not know, tsunamis are things which involved very small deformations of the ocean. Maybe a few tens of centimeters, this thing which I call Z on the diagram, exceptionally 1 meter during the Tohoku tsunami. But they are spread over enormous distances. Lambda is typically on the order of the width of the seismic zone, which is 300 kilometers at the most, which means that we're not going to see this on the surface. We cannot see a tsunami. Aha. Stay tuned. And they propagate, another number to remember is that they propagate under the shallow water approximation at a speed which is given by square root of gh, which is about 200 meters per second, or the speed of a jet plane. So this is good news and bad news. It's bad news because they propagate very slowly. If you've ever crossed the Pacific on an airplane, you know it's very long, but it's good news because it can give you a warning. Now, this is in deep water. Oh, when you come to a shoreline, things change. Obviously, the depth is reduced, so the speed is reduced, and therefore the energy has to be kept in some way, and the only way is to increase the amplitude, and this is how, when you consider the interaction with the coastline, you can get these images where you get 32 meters of flow depth here during the Sumatra tsunami. And you just run up inland to distances which can be kilometers, and therefore you can end up with a lot of destruction. So how do we address the problem of trying to model tsunamis? You start with F equals ma, and F equals ma was written by Navier and Stokes here in this form, where the force is, where you have a full derivative. And the force is, of course, something like a gradient of a pressure plus whatever force you put in there, plus the divergence of the stress tensor, which is generated in the fluid. And so you start all kinds of approximations, and I don't have too much time. If you can neglect the viscosity, you become Newtonian, and Newton at some point was worth £1 in England. If you can consider that the fluid is inviscid, which means that mu equals zero, then you become Eulerian, and Euler was worth 10 Swiss francs at some point. A very important thing is that since you need a full derivative in fluid mechanics, and that's the big difference between fluid mechanics and solid mechanics, if you need a full derivative, you introduce nonlinearity because you have this thing which is capital du dt is partial du dt plus u gradient u, and that's a nonlinear term, and that's a bit of a problem computationally. And then you can go into the shallow water approximation where you replace this with only a variable, which is the amplitude at the surface, and an average velocity, horizontal velocity in the layer, which happens to be about constant. So you get to these equations, which are reasonably simple, and then you put some kind of boundary conditions, and you end up with, in the shallow water approximation, with this well-known equation, which is that you have a velocity which is square root of gh, which is undispersed. So everything travels at the same time, which is, of course, only an approximation. So again, you you travel at the speed of a jet plane, and because the depth of the ocean varies from point to point, you may have a kind of Snell's law effect, which means focusing and defocusing. You know, those of you above a certain age here use these devices and know very well about focusing and defocusing, and you end up with these kinds of diagrams. This one we published about 30 years ago with Mark Woods. In particular, mid-oceanic ridges can focus tsunamis very efficiently, as was the case here during the Sumatra tsunami. So how do we go through the process of making these simulations? We obtain a model of earthquake rupture, so we have a seismological model. We compute the static deformation at the ocean bottom, these plugs which go up and down at the ocean bottom. We use them as initial conditions for the vertical surface displacement with zero initial velocity. And when we solve the hydrodynamic model in the form of the differential equations under the shallow water approximation, and then if we are really smart, we propagate it up and model the run-up at the receiving shore, step by step on a very short grid. And to give you an idea of what we do, we go through the equations for the static deformation of the ocean bottom, which were given by Mancinia and Smiley in 1971, in a sense generalized by Okada-san in 1985. And these are reasonably arcane expressions, but you can feed this into a computer, check your coding a couple of times, and you produce this kind of map of a displacement, and you use it as the initial condition for your simulations. And the end product of the simulations are things like this. You can have a snapshot at a given time, in this case about 3 hours after the earthquake in Chile. This is a modeling of a 1906 Valparaiso earthquake. Or you can have a map of the maximum amplitudes at any given time in the Pacific Ocean. Now this is done, and routinely, I must say. However, we go back to this map and we say, come on, you did two things which are completely incompatible with each other. The first one is this item number two, compute the static deformation of the ocean bottom. You assume that there is no water on top of it, okay? Well, maybe this is a good assumption, but we just assume that there is no water. And then at number four, you run the hydrodynamic model, assuming that the bottom is completely rigid, so negating what you did in number two. Well, in the end, it sort of works, which means that the coupling is very, very weak, but it is not very satisfactory. And this is how, in 1980, Stephen Ward came with this absolutely brilliant idea that the tsunamis were actually could be considered as a special branch of the free oscillations of the Earth. Now, I cannot give you a course of free oscillations, but you all know that the Earth has normal modes. One of them is the breathing mode at about 22 minutes. The other one is the so-called football mode, which in French we should call mode rugby, at 54 minutes and so on. And it turns out that Steve Ward introduced the idea that the tsunami is really a normal mode of the Earth when you give the Earth an additional layer which happens to be liquid, and that you put this at the top of the layering of the Earth. And this works in the following way. Essentially, if you consider the classical Rayleigh wave here, a Rayleigh wave can be prolonged mathematically into the ocean, and you don't change very much the vertical displacement. The pressure here was nearly zero, was zero if there is no ocean. It becomes nearly zero, and a very small component to the eigenfunction here. And you have a horizontal motion as well, which essentially, but not exactly, vanishes at the surface. You transfer this to the case of a tsunami, and what you find is that your vertical displacement, which was supposed to be zero at the bottom, if the bottom is totally rigid, is slightly negative. Here I've multiplied the amplitudes by 100 so that you can read them. The red line is continuous, but I've multiplied it by 100. And is prolonged into the Earth. Similarly, the pressure is continuous and decays slowly with depth inside the Earth. And you also have a horizontal component, which is nearly constant here in the tsunami, is, of course, discontinuous here because you're going from a fluid to a solid body, but you pick up a very slight lateral horizontal displacement component in the solid. Why is all this important? Because in 1970, Freeman Gilbert produced this extremely seminal paper in which he showed that the excitation of a normal mode of the Earth is proportional to the double scalar product of the moment tensor of the earthquake with the eigenstrain of the mode in question. And then you can sum over all the modes and you get all the synthetic seismograms you want. And this formula can be immediately adapted to the case of the tsunami mode. You don't have to change your codes or anything. You can adapt the formula immediately. And there are some immediate results. The eigenfunction is very small here. So the eigenstrain is going to be very small, and it means that to excite anything, you need a big earthquake. It's that simple. I mean, it's trivial, but it's worth repeating. The eigenfunction decays slowly in the solid Earth. You see this red line here from 5 to 200 kilometers, it decays rather slowly. So contrary to widely perceived idea, the tsunami, the excitation of a tsunami by the dependence on depth is going to be reasonably small. And then Y3, which is the horizontal displacement, is present in the solid Earth. So even a strike-slip earthquake is going to excite a tsunami. As paradoxical as it may sound, this is correct. So that shows that this normal mode approach to tsunamis is incredibly powerful because it handles any ocean to solid Earth coupling, including sedimentary layers. You don't have to assume that there is no water on top when you compute your static displacement. You don't have to assume that when you compute your propagation of a tsunami, you don't have to assume that the bottom is rigid, because it's not. And it works well at higher frequencies outside the shallow water approximation, but the drawback, of course, is that you must assume laterally homogeneous structure. It's very difficult to have a normal mode approach where one third of the Earth is a continent. Okay, and it's a linear theory, so it doesn't allow for very large amplitudes. But you can compute normal mode synthetics, and you have this beautiful dispersion here, and this computation is equivalent to a linear dispersive technique. So now I'm going to say, why do I go through all of this, and how can I address this problem of the coupling of the ocean with the Earth? And this came from Rainer Kind in Germany, who in 2005 noticed that he could see, after some filtering, of course, he could see tsunamis recorded on horizontal seismometers in the Indian Ocean. Tsunamis which were on islands in the Indian Ocean recorded on horizontal seismometers after filtering. And the same kind of observation was made by Roger Hansen at about the same year. And I jumped on this observation, which I found phenomenal, and I showed that this was actually recorded worldwide, and that the higher frequencies were picked up and could be, as I will show, could be quantified, and that the tsunami could be detected for smaller events. Here is a case, for example, in Hawaii. This is a Sumatra tsunami recorded in Hawaii after it's gone all the way from the Indian Ocean through the Drake Straits here and up the Pacific Ocean. And you can see that once you filter it, between 100 and 10,000 seconds, you have a signal. When you see a signal and you are a seismologist, you say, hey, I want to measure it and to quantify it. You can even see it without any filtering on this record in Hope, which is in South Georgia. And in order to quantify it, I use this record at Amsterdam, which is a French island, in the middle of the ocean, which sits on a very, very small island. And the way to address the problem is, how can we quantify this thing? Well, first of all, I'm going to use normal mode theory, if for no other reason, because there is this dispersion, which is so well represented. And then I'm going to make some rather drastic assumptions. I'm going to forget the island. I mean, you have a 5-kilometer island recording a wave which is supposed to have 300 kilometers of wavelength, and you can just shave the island off. and assume that your seismometer is actually sitting on the bottom of the ocean floor and records the records the horizontal motion of the ocean floor, at least the first approximation. And why can I do this? And even though it sounds outrageous, well, the end justifies the means, right? La fin justifie les moyens. So let's proceed. You can go and read more of Freeman Gilbert's paper, and you will see that a horizontal seismometer doesn't really record only the horizontal acceleration of the Earth, but it also records all kinds of things which have to do with tilt, variation in gravity, all kinds of things like this. Effects which, if you deal with a spherical mode, amount to something like, under the worst possible situation, about 10% of the amplitude. But if you deal with the tsunami waves and you compute all of these things, you find that you can reach an order of magnitude or so. So you've got to be very careful and use all these corrections. But the long story is that, to make a long story short, that what we find is that if we focus at 800 seconds, which is about where the amplitude is maximum, we find a moment of 1.7 10 to the 30th. And you remember that the Sumatra was given as 1.15 10 to the 30th, 1.2 later on, and so on. And it means that given the kind of approximations we've made, that's not bad at all. So it's acceptable given the extreme nature of the approximation. So actually, for a tsunami, a seismometer sitting on an island functions as an OBS at a significant fraction of the cost, of course. So we generalize this. This is the case of Maui, recorded in Raoul Island, Pitcairn, and where you can really do some interesting thing is that you can study, for example, the station averaged moment that you compute at various periods, and you can push the periods, you know, into the realm of Earth's normal modes, or even longer, and you find that you pretty much agree with a CMT moment, which means the Maui earthquake had no slowness, and that is an additional check on this property that comes from tsunami theory. So, having said this, I hope I've convinced you that actually the tsunami is prolonged and has part of its eigenfunction, parts of energy propagating in the Earth, right? How about up there? Well, up there, we use in all the simulations, we use a free surface boundary condition, you know, with a zero pressure, with a zero density of the air. Well, if we had an air of zero density, we would all be dead as animals, you know, because we couldn't breathe. So there is something there. And this was suggested as early as the 1970s by Dick Peltier, among others. The story is the following. The tsunami the tsunami amplitude here has to be continuous, but of course, the whole phenomenon, the whole wave, if you wish, will decay exponentially with height. Yes, the energy density of the wave will decay exponentially with height, but you know when you climb a mountain that the density of the atmosphere decays very fast with height, and you have trouble breathing at 3,000 meters or above. And so it so happens that the actual amplitude of the signal may increase with height when you reach these regions here, which are, you know, something like 70 kilometers and up. And that leads to the fact that the tsunami is also prolonged into the atmosphere, and this was detected by Artru and Kanamori and Philippe Lognonet and others even before the Sumatra earthquake, and of course verified and quantified by Lou and others, and of course Ninto here in France, who managed by measuring the total electronic content signal in the ionosphere, which is disturbed by the presence of that oscillation of the ionosphere, which can reach kilometers in amplitude. They were able, in a sense, to reconstruct the amplitude of a seismic moment. And I'm not going to, I mean, we've all heard about the beautiful things that Ninto and his group and Philippe Lennonet have done, and I'm just mentioning this for the record here. Now, another case which is kind of interesting to give you an idea of the power of this normal mode theory, which allows to measure the measure the coupling between the water column and the ground, is the case of the one of the largest bomb that the United States detonated, which was an H bomb detonated in 1969 on Amchitka Island here. There are a bunch of visionary people in Hawaii at the time, Martin Vitushek and others. They were building the prototype of what has been known as DARTs, which are these sensors on the ocean floor which measure a difference in pressure and can catch the passage of a wave. And they were in the know of what was going on, and so they deployed one of their guys here near Amchitka. And sure enough, they caught the tsunami, and they published it in some kind of proceedings of a tsunami meeting, which are completely lost in the gray literature. But I found it. I filtered their records. I measured this thing. And, I will get into the details of the computation if you're interested. But I was able to suggest 800 kT based on a back-of-the-envelope calculation of the normal mode excitation of the tsunami by an explosion in the Earth. And, the yield was 1 megaton, so you get 20% of the value from the back-of-the-envelope, and that's satisfactory enough. There are some more subtle coupling stories between the atmosphere and tsunamis. And we all know about the Nextel delivery service, so you can actually, using UPS or somebody else, you can actually deliver a tsunami by next day air. And this is what happened in Krakatoa in 1883. Now, you all heard about the explosion of Krakatoa in 1883, a wonderful place to visit if you have a chance. There was a catastrophic tsunami which killed 35,000 people in Batavia, which is now Jakarta. And Satake and one of his students showed that they could model the tsunami in Batavia using the standard approach. However, this tsunami was recorded worldwide on tidal gauges. They had tidal gauges. They didn't have seismometers in those days, but they had tidal gauges. And this would seem to contradict the dispersive nature of a short wavelengths associated with an explosion like this. You know, the wavelengths are not more than maybe 25, 30 kilometers, and they don't propagate very well. But, of course, press and Hark Rider showed that the tsunami was really an air wave. It was an ancillary phenomenon to an air wave, which was generated by the explosion in the atmosphere, and which propagated at the speed of sound, which is 340 kilometers per second as opposed to 220. So the tsunami actually arrives early. The tsunami crosses continents, which for a tsunami is a little difficult to interpret. And these guys, which were in the business of measuring various things in the atmosphere at the time, managed to estimate the power of the explosion to 100 and 150 megatons. So, and here are the records which they published. So you can actually deliver a tsunami through the air. That's interesting. Can you see a tsunami? I told you no, because the amplitude is too small and the wavelength is too large. And yet there are some stories of people who sits in lighthouses, you know, lighthouse keeper. That's a job which is on the go now. But there were people who spent 35 years on their life in a lighthouse. And they say, oh, Sam, when we have a tsunami, I can see it before. There's a tsunami shadow. So they were, told that after 35 years up there, you see things and you hear voices and whatnot. David Walker in Hawaii managed to catch one on a video camcorder, and his fellow Oleg Godin showed that he could estimate something which was due to turbulence at the surface, which would modify the index of refraction of the Earth, and he published this in early 2005, which means the paper had been submitted a year earlier, and I had the privilege to be a reviewer, and trying to understand what he was saying was difficult enough, but and he verified it on the JSON altimeter records of 2009. You can actually catch a tsunami this way. So these people in the lighthouses, after all, they were actually seeing the tsunami shadow. If you see the tsunami, can you hear it? And the story is interesting. In Diego Garcia, there are many things in Diego Garcia, but they also they have infrasound networks that can be beamed by very sophisticated techniques to tell you where the sound is coming from. And they found that the sound from the tsunami was coming from this area after Sumatra. Now, that's kind of interesting, because this is the epicentral area, and it wasn't coming from Sumatra and the Andaman, it was coming from Burma, or Myanmar, as it's known now. That's kind of funny, because Burma was a place where the tsunami was very weak, only about 2.9 meters and only about 100 deaths or so, as opposed to Thailand. So why? Well, maybe you should remember that a wave has a condition, I mean, it can break at the beach, okay? The word breakers, people go surfing, the wave breaks at the beach. And when it breaks, it does two things. It doesn't penetrate very far inland. You can stay on the beach and look at the breakers, and then it makes noise. Uh-huh. And so maybe if you look at the continental shelf here, you have an enormous continental shelf here in front of Burma, and a much narrower one in Thailand. And so probably the tsunami broke on the continental shelf here, which meant it didn't have energy to propagate to Myanmar, but it backscattered the infrasound all the way to Diego. So after all, yes, you can hear a tsunami. And finally, I want to say a few words that a tsunami can be detected in the geomagnetic field of the Earth. Before Sumatra, there were some theoretical studies, among others by Tyler at the University of Washington, which predicted that when you move a tsunami, you're moving a conductor. Remember, the salt water is a conductor. And so you're moving a conductor in the geomagnetic field of the Earth. So you're creating a current. That current creates a magnetic field, and so you should affect the magnetic field of the Earth. Unfortunately, and he has this formula which predicts, you know, the change in the magnetic field as a function of the amplitude of the tsunami. But unfortunately, during Sumatra, it turns out that the areas with the maximum displacement of the wave were at the magnetic equator, where you cannot observe this signal. Unfortunately, in the case of Chile, this was detected in the case of Chile, and you see here that there is a strong signal recorded at Easter Island at the time of the tsunami. And even though this fellow Manoj said that he couldn't match the amplitude, this is because he was comparing with the amplitude inside the harbor at Easter Island rather than the amplitude on the high seas. And this was later on during Tohoku, there was also a case like this. So as a conclusion, I hope I convinced you that the tsunami is certainly not limited to the ocean column. And if it were limited to the ocean column, we would never generate anything, because the largest source that we've had in the ocean column is Wigwam in 1955, which was a nuclear test by the American Navy inside the water column, 20 kT. And this is a picture of Wigwam. But we have coupling at the surface. At the surface, we have a factor of 1,000 in density. Now, that's a lot. But we are going from a fluid to a fluid. So it's all fluid mechanics, and it should be coupled, especially if you have a big source. And in the atmosphere, we do have big sources. We have Krakatau, which is 150 megatons. And we have the largest nuclear test, which was a Russian test in Novaya Zemlya, which was 57 megatons. But it was far in the Arctic, and the records have disappeared. And you have a second level of coupling, which is at the bottom of the ocean, where you go from something which has essentially zero rigidity to whatever rigidity the Earth has. And in the solid Earth, the biggest source we have is the Chilean earthquake for the time being, at 1960. And the full understanding of many, many tsunami properties mandates the modeling of these subtle coupling effects. And for these effects, the normal mode theory is wonderful. But they of course, require gigantic sources, because this coupling is very small. So I've certainly run out of time by now, and so I'll stop there, and I'll take your questions if the chair allows them. Thank you very much.